Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. Germany will not tamper with the fundamental principles of free movement in the EU, says German Chancellor Angela Merkel, an unwelcome message for David Cameron, who'd like to cap immigration as part of his EU renegotiation. And this evening, the Defence Secretary Michael Fallon admitted he'd made a mistake in warning that British communities are being swamped by immigration. Then there's the looming matter of that controversial demand from Brussels for an extra £1.7 billion contribution from Britain. But Ed Miliband's got problems of his own this weekend as well, after the bruising resignation of the Scottish Labour leader Joanne Lamont. James Lyons, deputy political editor for The Mirror, came in earlier to guide us through the coming political week, which starts with a statement from David Cameron about that EU summit. Would the Prime Minister still be seething, I asked?
I think on the basis of last week, you can guarantee he's going to be angry. I think we could see him thumping the dispatch box tomorrow and full of righteous fury. Really, he's got no choice. He's got to try and be more angry than the voters on this one. It's his only hope, is to make it look as if he's just as furious as everybody else.
Is there some compromise that can be reached, perhaps paying the money in stages? Because he said, I won't pay it by the deadline.
Yes, you're right. Even in the midst of his Hulk impersonation in Brussels last week, there were those weasel words where he kept saying, I will not pay it by December the 1st. And now I'm sure that they will try in Downing Street to get the headline figure down. There's certainly people around David Cameron, people in his team, have been talking very tough over the weekend about various strategies, just saying, no, we're not going to pay it, see you in court, or holding up other European Council business until this is sorted out. But it's difficult to see how he's going to get out of it. And I suspect that we're going to have a pretty hefty bill from Brussels landing on our doormat along with all the credit card bills in January.
Because there are other compromises and agreements that David Cameron wants to reach. I mean, principally over this idea that he has of changing the rules on free movement. Now, we heard that Angela Merkel has said, I won't envisage any change in those rules. Where do we go from here, then, if that's the situation?
Well, it was very interesting today when that point was put to Michael Fallon, you know, a very key ally of David Cameron.
The Defence Secretary.
On his first broadcast outing this morning, Michael Fallon seemed to actually backtrack a bit. And he was talking about renegotiating the EU rules so that we could curb benefits rather than migration. He then he performed another U-turn and an interview later on in the day, where he started saying, no, we are looking at things like limiting the number of national insurance numbers that are given out to foreign workers and other measures like that, which is the sort of thing that Angela Merkel has said is off the table. But he then proceeded to throw some petrol on the fire and talk about Britain being swamped by foreign workers and saying that some towns were under siege from the number of migrants coming here. That's earned him a stiff rebuke from Downing Street. Government sources have said tonight that he didn't mean to say that. He should have picked his words more carefully. And I think you can expect to see Labour picking up on that tomorrow when David Cameron delivers what was already going to be a very tricky statement in the Commons.
So he's admitted he made a mistake by talking about communities being swamped by immigration.
He says, we're told that he now concedes he should have said that communities were under pressure.
David Cameron has a number of challenges, we know, on Europe. And the other issue that's bubbling away at the moment is over the European arrest warrant. Yeah. It's one of a number of measures that Britain on December the 1st will opt out of and then opt back into. What is going to happen on that? Because there are a number of people within the Conservative Party who don't want to opt back into the European arrest warrant.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, if you listen to some people in the party, they're facing a three-figure rebellion on this, which is an extraordinary situation. And we've had over the weekend, we've had Damien Green, who's the former policing minister, and also the Home Secretary, Theresa May herself, coming out and saying how dangerous this would be. It would turn Britain into a Costa del crime, they say. So this is pretty high-stakes stuff. Now, Labour are insisting that they will help the government out here, that they will see the legislation through so that we can opt back in.
Because there has to be a vote in the Commons, doesn't there?
There absolutely has to be a vote in the Commons, yeah. There's no getting around that. The problem for David Cameron here is that he doesn't want to be seen to be relying on Labour votes in an issue which, you know, his own Home Secretary said is so vital to security and policing.
We've got the Rochester and Stroud by-election, haven't we, of course, on November the 20th, which is taking up a lot of ministers' and backbenchers' time. The Conservatives are campaigning hard there. But they've presumably also been campaigning from the Labour side and from the Conservative side in South Yorkshire, where there's an election for a new police commissioner for South Yorkshire after the resignation of Sean Wright.
Yeah, this seems to have been rather under off of a lot of people's radars, but this is potentially a very nasty moment for Ed Miliband at the end of this week. The contest was triggered, as you say, by the resignation of Sean Wright, who wasn't just the local policing czar, he'd also been on Rotherham Council. And UKIP are very much trying to exploit the Rotherham child sex abuse scandal, where, if you remember, there were 1,400 youngsters who were said to have been abused, admittedly over a long period of time, but still an absolutely staggering and horrific figure. Posters went up, UKIP posters went up this weekend, talking about 1,400 reasons not to vote Labour. And, people in the Labour Party are rightly worried about this.
So that's happening on Thursday. Let's look at another problem for Labour, and this is a growing problem, isn't it? The situation with the Scottish Party. Joanne Lamont has resigned as leader of the Scottish Party. Will there now be a sort of recognition with the Labour Party here that they have to let go of the Scottish Party, because she was saying that the Scottish Party was being treated like a branch office by the Westminster Party?
The first thing to say here is that you intrude on Scottish Labour politics at your peril. It does seem the situation is that she has made these remarks about Ed Miliband's operation and saying that she struggled to get decisions on things like opposing the bedroom tax. I think she said for a year while Ed Miliband decided what he was going to do about it. And also that they were meddling, they got rid of her general secretary without her asking. So that's her side of the argument. Other people in the Scottish Labour Party say that she was on her way out after the lacklustre, to say the least, referendum campaign. The truth is that the referendum campaign up there may have ended in a no vote, but it has changed everything. You know, I was talking to one Scottish MP this afternoon who was saying, this is a new country now, and people have got to understand that, and we've got to change the way that we do our business. And this is not a little local difficulty. Labour have 41 MPs in Scotland at the moment. You know, those MPs are going to be crucial if there's a tight outcome at the next general election, and some in the party fear they could lose as many as 15 if things aren't turned around, because we've seen a massive swing in support to the SNP.
And it's just been announced that we'll get the new leader's name on December the 13th.
Yep. The last contest took 3 months. The Labour Party have sensibly decided they can't wait that long this time round.
That's James Lyons, and listening to that here with me in the studio is Charlie Elphick, Conservative MP for Dover. And joining us on the line from his Copeland constituency is Labour's Jamie Reid. Welcome, both of you. Jamie Reid, first of all, that situation in Scotland, Joanne Lamont resigning, saying she'd been undermined by the removal of her general secretary and by the Labour leadership's propensity to treat the Scottish Labour Party like a branch office. Is that a way to treat a party leader?
I don't think that is, certainly from my perspective, how Joanna has been treated. Certainly.
Well, she's lying.
I'm not for a second saying she's lying. I met Joanne during the Scottish referendum. I spent a fortnight up there sleeping on floors and knocking on doors. It was a very, very hard-fought campaign. And Joanne played a hugely a pivotal part, I'd say, in the Victory for the Better Together campaign. I think she has, like all leaders, I think, a sense of unfinished business when they eventually stand down. I think it's worthwhile pointing out that the General Secretary in Scotland resigned. He wasn't sacked. So I think there are issues to be resolved there, clearly. But I think there's some really big issues to be resolved, not just with regard to Scotland, but England as well, going forward with regard to the constitutional settlement.
Well, there certainly are big problems. She wants an autonomous Scottish Labour Party. She says the Labour Party must recognise that the Scottish Party has to be autonomous and not just a branch office of a party based in Scotland. That's a direct quote. Now, do you accept that the leadership at Westminster has failed to recognise that Scotland's changed and it needs to give up trying to control the Scottish Party?
I don't accept at all that the leadership in Westminster's not acknowledged or refused to accept that Scotland's changed. I think the whole of Britain has changed as a result of the Scottish referendum, but I think it was changing anyway. And actually, I'd go further and I'd say that it was really Ed Miliband and the people around Ed Miliband who were the first to clock that change. That's why we were talking about One Nation. That's why we were talking about all of the other
issues.
But
in terms of the leadership of the party, it has to now come from Scotland, doesn't it? Not from Westminster. It has to come from Holyrood
I think that's absolutely correct, and I think that's something that we're already ahead of the curve on. So the leader of the Scottish Labour Party, the new leader of the Scottish Labour Party, will be the leader of Scottish MPs in Westminster, will be leader of Scottish MSPs, and leader of the party in Scotland with a huge amount of sovereignty and individual ability to do what he or she wants
to do. Can I just ask you about that then? I mean, the leader has to renounce any link to Westminster, though, doesn't he or she, if once they're elected? I mean, don't you have to, if you're sending a signal now that the Scottish Party is a Scotland-based party, don't you have to renounce links to Westminster and base yourself at Holyrood?
I think if we accept that we are one nation, and I think that that's what the settled will of the Scottish people came through as being with regard to the referendum, and I think it would be foolish to completely jettison any and all links to Westminster. I think if we are a one nation party, which the Labour Party is, if there's an argument for saying it's really the only credible unionist party left, I think to turn around and say, look, we don't want to have anything to do with Westminster, I think would be foolish, and I don't think it would be in Scotland's best interest, irrespective of the Labour Party's best interest.
This is playing into the SNP's hands. It's given them value ammunition at a time when Labour's trailing the SNP in voting intentions, and there's a real question mark over whether you can hold on to your 41 Scottish seats.
I don't think so. I think, I mean, we see Alex Salmond on the airwaves incessantly, it would appear, after he only a few weeks ago said that the this question would be put to bed for a generation, still trying to fight the fight of the last 2 years. I think that there's going to be, clearly going forward, lots of heat around Scotland's place in the United Kingdom and what the new constitutional settlement will be. That's why we're engaging significantly and in a detailed fashion with the Smith Commission, because we're serious about these issues. We want to resolve these issues. And genuinely, this isn't a party political game. This is about the future of Scotland and it's about the future of the United Kingdom.
But you're not engaging in the English Votes for English laws, are you?
Well, I think that's a very, very different issue. So I think that the issue of English votes for English laws is something which does need to be considered. It's something certainly I'm considering and other colleagues are considering. In fact, we've been considering this for some time, but that's largely a red herring. If we're talking about a new constitutional settlement for England, then EVEL has an awful lot of rope in it which needs to be understood clearly. And I think that the real way to do this is for better, more effective powers to be devolved to the English regions.
Let's save the detail on that for other weeks. We will have plenty of time to talk about it. Now, Charlie, we're looking at this issue of what's happening in Europe. An extra $1.7 billion demanded by Brussels from the UK. David Cameron's not very happy about that. And then Angela Merkel comes along and says, oh, by the way, I'm not going to help you out in terms of sorting out free movement. He's overreached himself, hasn't he? He's promised something in terms of tackling free movement that he can't deliver. Legally, he can't.
Well, I don't agree, as you'd expect. Taking first the 1.7...
Why not? Because
let's take the £1.7 billion first. These are rules which have been in place since 1995. There's occasionally a small adjustment up and down. You don't get big adjustments like this. And for people out there wondering, you know, are we serious when we say we're going to be taking the battle to Europe? We are the party that got the rebate in the 1980s. We're the party that delivered an £8 billion cut in the EU budget, and Labour are the party that delivered a $7 billion giveaway of our rebate.
Maybe
so
he will be
I think
able
I trust David Cameron,
payment.
But I think I trust David Cameron rather than Ed Miliband to ensure that we get a really best deal out of Europe.
Should he say, I will not pay, as opposed to I will not pay on the 1st of December?
I think it's the right that we go into discussion with our European partners and say, look, this is ludicrous. And David Cameron has actually been working
and say,
very closely.
No, we won't pay at all.
Well, David Cameron's working with the other countries who've been affected by this to make the strong case. And I rather suspect that there'll be quite drastic changes. And I would hope it will return to the sort of normal small adjustments rather than this kind of £1.7 billion bill.
And on free movement, I mean, you know, Angela Merkel says it can't happen. The lawyers say it can't happen. Isn't he promising something he can't deliver, just like getting immigration to the tens of thousands? That didn't happen.
Well, people are always saying that David Cameron can't achieve things, and then he then goes and achieves things, like the cut in the budget I just mentioned, like getting us off the hook for Eurozone bailouts. And obviously he vetoed that treaty when it wasn't in the UK's interest. So David Cameron has form of being quite strong on Europe and getting quite a good negotiated settlement.
Do you feel in Dover under siege from large numbers of migrant workers and people claiming benefits, as Michael Fallon originally said some towns do?
think when I talk to people in Dover, they are very deeply concerned and very sensitive to the issue of immigration. And you've got to look back just a few years as to why that is. We allowed Eastern European states to join the European Union, have full free movement to the UK. We're the only country, other than us and Ireland, that didn't have any transitional controls. And it caused a massive change. People are very sensitive to it because of Labour's open border, unchecked migration policies.
In terms of the numbers of migrant workers coming into your constituency, at the moment, it's looking as if you can't do anything to stop them as long as we're in the EU. So is it, if we can't control free movement, really, let's leave the EU?
I think that would be
What's
prejudging.
What's your personal view?
My personal view is that we need to look more carefully at free movement and particularly look at the issue of welfare tourism. The problem, most people say to me, is not if people come here to do a job. The real problem is when they come here, sign up for benefits, sign on for housing priorities, sign on to use the NHS as an international health service. And it's those measures that we've been taking to deal with that which are really important.
And Jamie, your leader also wants stronger controls on people coming here. He's called for reform of the European Union's freedom of movement rules. I mean, same question to you. What can you do legally?
Well, I think this actually, if we look at this issue in tandem with the £1.7 billion bill that the European Commission has just asked us to pay, I think there's a key element here. There's a golden thread, if you like, and that's the inability, the chronic inability of David Cameron to do a deal for Britain in Europe. So I think Ed Miliband's got this absolutely right. We need to see a fair movement of labour, not necessarily unfettered free movement of labour. People can come here to work. They can't come here on a fast-track ticket simply to claim benefits and not pay into the system. Mm. There has to be not just an element, but an absolute insistence upon reciprocity here. You can't take out without putting in.
Let's look at the European arrest warrant. There's going to be a vote on this, and it looks as if 100 Tory MPs, maybe up to 100 Conservatives, are going to oppose government plans to opt back into the European arrest warrant. Now, Charlie, you were one of those who wanted these measures originally opted out of, 130 or so. What about opting back into the European arrest warrant? Are you for that or against it?
Well, that's right. I fought for us not to block opt-in, so that we should only opt in to those which pass what I call a test of cooperation versus control. We don't want a situation where we are having Brussels tell us what to do, but we do need to cooperate. And I'll give an example. I represent Dover. Cross-border smuggling, cross-border criminals, drug running, gun running, people trafficking is a real problem. We have to cooperate with our European colleagues if we're to stamp out this problem and to take the battle to the people traffickers. And that's something I feel very, very passionate about.
So some of your colleagues, though, who are saying that they would oppose the opting back in, what do you say to them? Do you support them?
Well, I think we need to look at each one that we're looking at opting back into and ask ourselves the question, is it cooperation or is it control? And with the European arrest warrant, it's really important that you get the balance right and have the right safeguards.
Well, Theresa May has said that ditching it would lead to Britain becoming a honeypot for all of Europe's criminals on the run from justice. Would you like that?
Theresa May is very passionate about law and order, as is the Home Office, as is the police forces and the security services, and you'd expect them to be so. But I think the right balance needs to be that you can't have the European arrest warrant abused to catch thieves of piglets, teddy bears, puddings, or indeed Hampshire police trying to capture the parents of Aisha King in Spain. I think that has undermined confidence in the whole arrest warrant process.
Well, Jamie, is Labour going to back the government on this? I mean, if it's got up to 100 Conservative rebels, they will need the Labour Party to get this measure through.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think this is what happens when David Cameron spends his time dealing with Europe as some kind of way within which to appease his backbenchers rather than looking out for what is clearly, as Charlie points out there, in the best interests of Britain and the people in this country. So, yes, we will be supporting the government if it decides to do the right thing and not back into the European arrest warrant. It's clearly in the best interests of British people.
And what about on the budget row? You've got to back David Cameron, because if you don't, many Labour voters will be persuaded to vote UKIP, won't they?
I think we've got to look really carefully at this. We've said that this demand is a completely unreasonable demand from an outgoing commission, and the incoming commission, a new commission, will expect have very, very different views and expectations on what it expects, not just Britain but other member states to pay. But again, I make the point, and it's now self-evident to anybody with even a cursory understanding of these issues, David Cameron isn't delivering for Britain in Europe.
The statement from David Cameron tomorrow. Jamie, Charlie, thanks very much indeed. The picturesque North Wales town of Llangollen has been the venue this weekend for Plaid Cymru's annual conference. The party has seen a decline in its fortunes in the past decade and is trying to grapple with issues including the future of devolution and an NHS whose failings have placed it in the UK political spotlight. Leanne Wood, the party leaders, expressed excitement at the Scottish referendum result in which 45% voted for independence. But in Wales, one recent poll showed support for independence at only 3%. An all-time low. I asked Leanne Wood why she thought that might be.
We are in a different place in Wales, and we're in a different place in Plaid Cymru to where the SNP are as well. And our devolution settlement started off at different places. There was already a devolved criminal justice system in Scotland, a devolved education system in Scotland. We started from scratch in Wales. So while we're on the same journey, we are at different stages, but I'm confident we are all going in one direction.
But you would like to make more of a breakthrough, wouldn't you, in terms of seats, for example? I mean, one leading expert on Welsh politics, Professor Roger Scully of Cardiff University, noted recently that your party's hardly further on in support than it was in 1992.
Well, that gives us all to play for in terms of building and growing, doesn't it? So we're looking towards the next election where we could be in a position together with the SNP and our colleagues in the Green Party where we hold the balance of power. And so this election, unlike the last one in 2010 when Plaid Cymru suggested that there could be a hung parliament, many people didn't believe us. This time I think that claim is more credible and the outcome could be that we hold the balance of power. And if we do that, then what Plaid Cymru will do is take steps to make sure that we can rebalance wealth and power in these islands, because at the moment Wales loses out, particularly if you look at comparisons with Scotland. So I'm putting forward the case that Wales should receive parity with Scotland in terms of powers and in terms of finance.
In order to get that, though, you'll have to do a deal with somebody. Would you be willing to do a deal with David Cameron to keep him in office?
It's unlikely. I couldn't see a situation whereby Plaid Cymru, which is a left of centre progressive party, would support a Conservative government. That would be difficult. What I'm putting forward is an alternative to a potential Tory UKIP alliance. There could be an alternative to the left, a progressive alliance of Greens, the SNP and Plaid Cymru, and we can put forward an alternative to the arguments around austerity, for example.
But that would involve doing a deal with Ed Miliband.
Well, probably a full coalition may not be as likely as some sort of agreement whereby there could be certain concessions in exchange for support for budgets, for example, and legislation. So there are alternative models to a coalition, but I wouldn't rule that out at this stage. Clearly, we want to try and get the best deal for Wales. If we had in Wales the same finance per head of the population as people get in Scotland in relation to England, then we would get an additional £1.2 billion every year for our public services. And given how much we've put in the past and not had back, and given as well that our next aim in Wales has to be to achieve end our financial dependence, then that is a good way to start levelling up the playing field so that we can get to the point where we're in a position to stand on our own 2 feet. And then we'll be able to be in a position to make the same options available to people in Wales as were available in Scotland.
But UKIP has come from nowhere to score 28% in Wales in the elections to the European Parliament, and they almost beat Labour to top the poll. So the sort of people that you're talking about who are seeking an alternative, research suggests that a lot of those vote UKIP. They feel they're left behind. They haven't done well out of globalisation and economic growth. These are the very people that you say Plaid represents. Don't you feel rather humiliated that they'd rather vote for UKIP rather than you?
If Plaid Cymru had the same level of coverage as UKIP has had, then I'm fairly confident that we would be doing much better in the polls as well. We're going to be excluded alongside the SNP and the Greens from the party leaders' debates, for example. And what will be on offer...
Are you challenging that?
Yes, there are challenges to that, because what will be on offer, there will be four shades of Westminster grey. They will all be arguing around the same territory in terms of immigration, welfare, austerity, and there is an alternative view to that that could be put forward by Plaid Cymru, the SNP, the Green Party. We should be there. It's a basic question of democracy.
Just to go back to the fact that people are looking elsewhere and perhaps not moving to Plaid in the numbers that you would like, would some rebranding of the party perhaps help? Are people put off voting for you because they think that your belief in an independent socialist Welsh Republic isn't something that chimes with them?
Well, we'll have to see, won't we? What I'm picking up at the moment is that people are fed up with the Westminster establishment. People have just had enough and they are looking for something different. Mm. And Plaid Cymru can offer something different. And I think now is the time that people are looking for a radical kind of politics as well. And that's what happened that I saw when I went to Scotland. That was the alternative that people were looking towards, and I want us in Wales to have a similar debate about the future of our nation. Do we follow the drag towards the right, or do we say, no, that's not the direction in which we are going, we're going to do something else? And I hope that people will see that if we can get our message out through the media, that people will see that Plaid Cymru offers that alternative to the Westminster establishment elite.
That's Leanne Wood, the Plaid Cymru leader. Well, while devolved government in Wales and Scotland is forging ahead, in Northern Ireland, the political parties sharing power have been unable to agree on fundamentals like a budget for the executive or even a speaker for the Stormont Assembly. The result is deadlock in the power-sharing institutions, and the former US Senator Gary Hart's been appointed to support negotiations which began last week and could last several months to try to break it. Leela Padmanabhan has been to Belfast to investigate.
BBC.
How are you? Hi,
I'm Brian. Thanks. So you knew I was coming, didn't you?
Yes,
yeah,
you did.
Brilliant. So I'm just going to hop off at Stormont.
Belfast city centre, and I hop on the bus and join a handful of rain-soaked tourists for some sightseeing with our cheery guide Brian at the mic. First stop, the shipyards that built the Titanic. Next, a gallop through a history of the Troubles as we take the road to Stormont.
And there, straight ahead, the very impressive Parliament buildings of Northern Ireland. They were designed to be impressive. The building's now home of the Assembly. And the Assembly came out of the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. The Good Friday Agreement brought an end to 30 years of violence. It's a framework that has allowed two political opposites to work together for the common good.
But the working together isn't going so well. So I'm here in the Great Hall of the Parliament building at Stormont. A very grand marble room, like Central Lobby at Westminster, in that there are lots of comings and goings, lots of meetings. And in fact, they were sitting here in these Parliament buildings till 1:30 this morning debating legislation on human trafficking. But alongside this activity, there are deep, deep problems which are threatening the very existence of the Northern Ireland Assembly and the Executive. Power sharing between political opponents is at the heart of the Good Friday Agreement. All the major parties are in government, and the two largest, the Democratic Unionists, or DUP, and the Nationalists, Sinn Féin, have equal power, but are political enemies. Mike Nesbitt leads the Ulster Unionist Party, once a key player in the political process, but which has lost support to the DUP.
We have this mandatory coalition with five parties in it, and that was designed in 1998 when we were coming out of the conflict. So we were creating a set of political institutions which were big enough to give everybody a slice of the cake. But now that we've moved away largely from violence and we're looking at these institutions, we recognise that they're not efficient and effective. And the problem is right at the heart of it. The two really big parties who were polar opposites, the DUP and Sinn Féin, when they were carving things up between themselves, it worked to an extent. But now that they've fallen out, nothing works, and we have the stalemate.
The main cause of the stalemate, money, or the lack of money in the age of austerity. The government at Westminster introduced real terms cuts to Northern Ireland's devolved budget, which is already more than £200 million in the red. Leaders here are under pressure to cut spending and introduce welfare reforms, similar to those pursued in England and Wales. Failure to do so has already meant fines of £87 million from the UK Treasury, increasing the budget shortfall even more. Professor John Tung from Liverpool University, an expert on Northern Ireland, explains the context.
95% of Stormont's budget comes from a block grant from Westminster, so it's hugely fiscally dependent upon Westminster. And Westminster doesn't think that Northern Ireland is worth sparing from the cuts that have been inflicted elsewhere. And let's face it, although Northern Ireland departments certainly have had to make serious spending cuts, they're not on the scale that, for example, English local authorities have had to make.
The man in charge of trying to manage Northern Ireland's budget and agree a programme of welfare reform is the Finance Minister, Simon Hamilton, from the Unionist DUP.
We're not all happy with every aspect of welfare reform, you know, but we have a system where four parties are content to move forward on the basis of a special package of measures that we have negotiated with the London government. We're prepared to move forward on that. Three other parties are, but Sinn Féin, unfortunately, are digging their heels in.
We are opposed to welfare cuts, and we have witnessed what has happened in Britain, and we have no intentions or wish to introduce such policies upon the people we represent.
Sinn Féin's John O'Dowd, Northern Ireland's Education Minister. Sinn Féin, a firmly left-of-centre party, has been campaigning against austerity in both the north and south of Ireland.
When people sort of narrow this down into the problem is welfare reform or welfare cuts, whichever label you want to put on it, they're missing the point. Our executive has been underfunded now for at least 5 years. You cannot separate the welfare issue from it. This is an economic question, and it goes to the heart of the British government's economic policy, which is concentrated largely around the southeast of England, and the rest of us have to survive what falls off the table.
The deadlock is causing paralysis. Finance Minister Simon Hamilton again.
Very serious consequences if we can't get a budget agreed. I've watched colleagues in Scotland and Wales put their draft budgets out in the last couple of weeks. We should have done likewise around about the same time. We still don't have a draft budget agreed and out to consultation. If we don't have that in place, obviously by the start of the next financial year, then we're into all sorts of difficult situations where civil servants are having to step in and allocate money to departments. And that's not the sort of situation that we want to be in, where civil servants are making those sorts of decisions. That's what we are elected to do.
In the aftermath of the referendum on Scottish independence, the parties in Scotland and Wales are discussing acquiring more powers over taxation and spending. Professor John Tung, though, is doubtful similar demands on Westminster from Northern Ireland will bear fruit.
There's a paradox because you get Assembly members in Northern Ireland calling for more powers for the Assembly, for example, cuts in corporation tax to stimulate a largely non-existent economy. But if you can't get consensus over the current state of political play, then where is the incentive for Westminster to devolve further powers to Northern Ireland?
So, quite a lot for the multi-party talks convened by the Northern Ireland Secretary Theresa Villiers to address. Sinn Féin's John O'Dowd.
The budget's on the table, welfare cuts are on the table, the outstanding matters of the Good Friday Agreement are on the table, political relationships are on the table, and all those things are being discussed out.
If the talks don't succeed, there's talk of bringing forward elections to the Assembly, which are due in 2016, or even going back to direct rule from Westminster, a last resort which has already been taken several times. Shoppers I spoke to in Belfast seem disillusioned and resigned.
They're fighting among themselves like children.
I think the politicians there have been voted in by the people to do the job, and they need just to get on with it now and look at how they can get over the barriers that they're putting up themselves.
Totally useless.
You don't have much confidence in them?
No confidence in them, any of them, whatsoever.
And would you be worried about direct rule again from London?
Wouldn't bother me. So it wouldn't.
Now, before we do hit the top of the Shankill Road, we will go past one of Belfast's 22 peace lines.
The return leg of the Belfast sightseeing tour, with a new guide, the irrepressible Chris, and some glaring symbols of Northern Ireland's troubles.
Here it is, straight ahead of us. Now, this is the largest of them. It was the first one as well. Walls like this were originally used to segregate communities on either side entirely, where violence got so bad between them.
But wasn't power sharing meant to heal the divisions of the past? Professor Tung offers this bleak assessment.
The Assembly has delivered very little in terms of bridging that sectarian divide. The executive itself has produced worthy documents about how Northern Ireland should be reintegrated, but that reintegration hasn't taken place. In housing, Northern Ireland is as separate as ever. In terms of education, the percentage of people in integrated schools remains in single figures. So it's a cold peace. You know, it's a peace which is still based upon a benign apartheid.
Alistair MacDonald, leader of the mainly nationalist SDLP, admits dealing with the legacy of the past is hard going.
Almost 4,000 were killed, 40,000, 50,000 were maimed. we have a high dependency as a result of that. That adds to our already high dependency on welfare. When we got some sort of a peace deal with the Good Friday Agreement, we thought we were in the promised land. That was only the first half of the match. We now have to build the peace.
Front of our bus passing his house now. Look, don't you right into that man's garden. That's right, that fella has an outdoor swimming pool.
Back in the rain-battered bus, a reminder of the resilient spirit that helped this troubled province move from conflict to relative peace and security. The history of Northern Ireland's political process has always been one of slow incremental steps forward, with many setbacks along the way.
That report from Leela Padmanabhan brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Westminster Hour. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good evening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.